From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. A special guest on this edition of Fresh Air to help us celebrate the season, jazz singer Susanna McCorkle is here for a live concert of Christmas songs. Also today, I speak with playwright-turned-screenwriter Kevin Wade. Wade has a hit with his first script to make it to the screen, the new comedy Working Girl, starring Melanie Griffith, Sigourney Weaver, and Harrison Ford. Rock historian Ed Ward plays some of his favorite Christmas rock and roll, and critic-at-large Laurie Stone tells us if Bill Cosby, television star, still makes it as a stand-up comic. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Christmas is a holiday that comes complete with a very large repertoire of songs. And let's face it, every year at this time, we're treated to some pretty corny versions of those songs. So to breathe new life into some old favorites, we've invited Susanna McCorkle to perform a holiday concert. Jazz critic Frances Davis called Susanna the outstanding female jazz singer of her generation. Susanna McCorkle has recorded a series of albums featuring the work of some of her favorite composers, including Johnny Mercer, Harry Warren, and Leo Robin. She recently signed with Concord Records, and her first album with this label is due out in February. Susanna has performed for us before on Fresh Air, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her back. Accompanying her today is pianist Lee Musiker and bassist Dean Johnson. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. Have yourself Christmas, make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. Faithful friends who are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together. If the yourself a merry little Christmas.
That's always such a sad song. It was actually an even sadder song I just read in one of those books of Hollywood anecdotes that you're always so ashamed of yourself for reading, but you keep on reading. When it was written by Blaine and Martin for Judy Garland, she said, "This is too sad. I'm going to be, it's a sad moment. Our family's about to move to New York. We're afraid we won't be together again after this Christmas. But it's the words are so sad. This Christmas may be our last. And if I sing it sad and the song is sad, it'll be too sad. So just make it more neutral, and then I'll be sad, and then it won't be too much of one thing." I love that idea of Judy Garland sitting down with the songwriters and talking about it, the idea that you could be there when a great song is born, and as a singer who really thinks about what you're singing, have something to do with it and to say about it. And it is really enduring classic song that we just don't get tired of.
I think it's one of the best Christmas songs.
It is.
I'm glad you opened with it.
Christmas is sad. There is always a longing about Christmas, longing for what we never knew, even, except from the movies.
What's your next song?
This is another movie song. This one was written by Irving Berlin, who wrote so many great holiday songs. He wrote them for holidays we don't even celebrate anymore, and he loved being American. He was from Russia, loved paying taxes. He loved America so much. And this is a song he wrote for cold weather. 1, 2, 3, 4.
The snow is snowing, the wind is blowing, but I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm. I can't remember a worse December. Just watch those icicles form. What do I care if icicles form? On fire, the flame grows higher, so I will weather the storm. What do I care how much it may storm? I've got my love to keep me warm.
Every year, are you called on to sing Christmas songs?
I am, but I don't mind it. I love special occasions and holidays. I really like doing them, and there are a lot of beautiful Christmas songs. I like all the carols, too.
Could we take a little poll about favorite and worst of the Christmas songs, what you think is the best and the worst?
Okay, Lee Musiker first. He's very opinionated.
Definitely, most definitely, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas is one of my favorites. So I agree with you, Terry. On that.
At worst? Do we have a nomination
worst?
No, that's the best.
That's the best.
You were very anti-Jingle Bells, Lee.
Well, I don't like to express that opinion in public, but that's... I'll just go with the best, the top one.
Dean, venture an opinion?
I don't really have a favorite, but the Christmas song is one I like, Mel's
Oh, how fortunate. We happen to be doing that later on in the show.
Susanna, what do you think?
Okay, the one I hate the most, because I just found a Frank Sinatra album, and on one side it's all carols, which he sings beautifully, simply and beautifully, Silent Night or Little Town of Bethlehem. On the other side, there are more commercial songs, including some of the great ones we've done, like Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. But there's also Oh, By Gosh, By Golly, Mistletoe and Holly. I'd say that's one that I don't want to sing.
I
could really hear the songwriters cranking that one out. Let's come up with a Christmas song. But there were even recently, Jingle Bell Rock was a good song, I thought, which was a hit maybe in the late 50s or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to do a nice one next.
Yeah, I'm going to do one that I think is the most evocative one about Christmas for all of us, because many of us won't be going home for Christmas or can't be going home for Christmas, or the home that we think of as home doesn't exist anymore. So it's a very touching song to hear and to sing, because it has so much meaning for everybody, especially these Christmas songs that are so familiar. Everybody has one particular time that he or she thinks of with a song like this.
That was a beautiful version of that.
Thank you.
That beautifully.
I love that song.
Let me reintroduce all of you. For our listeners just joining us, we're doing a special live Christmas concert. Singing is Susanna McCorkle, who, by the way, has a new album coming out in February on the Concord Jazz label. And we have Lee Musiker at the piano and Dean Johnson on bass. And what we're going to do is take a very short break. Then we'll be back with more Christmas songs. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We have a live Christmas concert with singer Susanna McCorkle. Susanna, the next song you're going to do is a song I've never heard, so I'm especially glad you're going to do it.
Thank you. I only know one recorded version of it by the great Fats Waller, one of my favorite musicians, made in the 1930s. I know the melody was written by Sam Coslow, who wrote My Old Flame. It's one of those little novelty songs that Fats made immortal because he's just such a great singer. And I guess if any one music inspired me, it's 30s music because it has that infectious swing and cheerfulness. I just love it. It doesn't sound dated or nostalgic at all to me. So this one's for Fats from us. 1, 2, 3, 4.
There's 4th of July in both your eyes, Easter Sunday too. 'Cause every day's a holiday since the day that I found you. Each heaven on earth day feels like a birthday, May Day rendezvous. 'Cause every day's a holiday since the day that I found you. They ought to hang the flags out, they ought to close the banks. Though it's not November, I feel like giving thanks. You're a happy new year, a movie premiere, a Christmas present too. 'Cause every day's a holiday since the day that I found.
Good song.
Yeah. All-purpose holiday song for any band, any society band.
And I'm sure that comes in really handy. Yeah. Well, the next song you're going to do is much more familiar.
Yes, this one was written by Mel Torme with someone else. I'm pretty sure Mel wrote the lyrics, and I don't, but I'm sure one of your staff will be glad to research this while we're singing it. Anyway, this is dedicated to a great musician. Mel Torme gave us a Christmas song that they'll be singing into the next century, I'm sure.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright. Tiny little tots, their eyes all aglow, will find it hard to sleep tonight. They know that Santa's on his way. He comes with lots of toys and goodies in his sleigh. And every mother's child is gonna spy to see if reindeer really know how to fly. So I'm offering this simple phrase for kids from 1 to 92. Though it's been said many times, many ways, Christmas, Merry Christmas to you.
Beautiful. We're featuring a live concert today of Christmas songs with singer Susanna McCorkle, and we have at the piano Lee Musiker and at the bass Dean Johnson. The next song that you're going to do, absolutely everybody knows, Santa Claus is Coming to Town.
Oh, yes. This is one of my earliest childhood songs because it's quite scary if you listen to it as a child. Better watch out, better not cry. You know, don't. He knows when you're sleeping, he knows when you're awake, and if you've been bad. You know, from the time I can remember understanding words, I always thought, what does this song mean? Oh, how long before Christmas do I have to be good to get any presents and have Santa Claus come? What's going on here? You know, it's quite a terrifying song. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, you better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town. He's making a list, checking it twice, gonna find out who's naughty or nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He knows when you are sleeping, he knows when you're awake. Good for goodness sake. Oh, you better watch out, you better not cry, better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town.
Great tribute to a singer when they can make Santa Claus is Coming to Town sound that good. Can you sing Winter Wonderland for us?
I hope Santa's gonna come now. Winter Wonderland we're gonna do? Okay.
Yeah. 1, 2, 3, 4. Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland. Gone away is the bluebird, here to stay is the new bird. To sing a love song as we go along, walking in a winter wonderland. In the meadow we can build a snowman and pretend that he's Parson Brown. He'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, man, but you can do the job if you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire to face unafraid the plans that we made walking in a winter wonderland. In a winter
wonderful. And we have just enough time to close with a song that I think you have to close every Christmas concert with.
Oh, yes. This is by Irving Berlin. He was the best at writing holiday songs. And this one, we have the verse, which is not usually heard. It makes the song a completely different song, not just about a Christmas with snow, but about going back home and having the kind of Christmases you used to have and remember best and love best. The sun is shining, the grass is green, the orange and palm trees sway. There's never been such a day in Beverly Hills, L.A. But it's December the 24th, and I'm longing to be up north. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. Treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
Thank you for a very, very beautiful concert.
We've loved doing it.
That was
Thank
gorgeous.
You for inviting us to.
My guests have been singer Susanna McCorkle, pianist Lee Musiker, and bassist Dean Johnson. And Susanna has a new album on a new label coming out in February. Her new album will be on the Concord Jazz Record label. And you can look for her earlier albums in the record bins as well. That's Susanna McCorkle. Thanks so much to all of you. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas. And on the next Fresh Air, my guest will be singer Benny King, so I hope you can join us. Would you guys play us out?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. One morning in downtown Manhattan, writer Kevin Wade watched thousands of women wearing sneakers and carrying heels heading for another day at the office. Wade says it was that image that gave him the idea for his screenplay, Working Girl. Now that screenplay has been made into a movie starring Melanie Griffith, Harrison Ford, and Sigourney Weaver. Coming up, we meet Kevin Wade. Also, rock historian Ed Ward gets with the spirit of the season and plays some of the best and some of the schlockiest Christmas rock and roll. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone reviews Bill Cosby's stand-up act at Carnegie Hall. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Brian Naylor. Investigators say the flight recorders of Pan Am Flight 103 leave no obvious clues as to what happened to the jumbo jet that caused it to crash Wednesday, killing all 258 on board and more on the ground. A British Department of Transport spokesman said the recording ends abruptly after what was described as a faint noise, but that there was nothing in the conversations of the crew to indicate anything was wrong. The noise will be further analyzed. Investigators sifting through the debris of the 747 scattered about Lockerbie, Scotland, have yet to find any evidence that a bomb went off aboard the flight, but have not ruled out sabotage as a cause. Flight 103 was among the issues raised today by PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat following his audience with Pope John Paul II. Arafat's visit to Rome was the latest on his European tour to seek support for the newly proclaimed Palestinian state. From Rome, Sylvia Pajoli reports.
In his 20-minute audience at the Vatican today, Pope John Paul told Arafat that Israelis and Palestinians have identical fundamental rights to their own homeland, in which to live in freedom, dignity, and security, and in harmony with their neighbors. A Vatican statement said the Pope wanted to encourage dialogue to seek an equal solution to the Mideast conflict, excluding every form of recourse to weapons and violence, and above all to terrorism and reprisal. Earlier, Arafat met with Italian government officials. He called for new UN initiatives for a resumption of the negotiating process and creation of an international peace conference. At a press conference this afternoon, Arafat said that if the Pan Am 747 crash in Scotland was not an accident, it was a criminal action directed against all humanity. For National Public Radio, this is Sylvia Poggioli in Rome.
Israeli Foreign Minister Moshe Arens today linked the crash of Flight 103 to Palestinian factions. Interviewed on Israeli radio, Arens said Israeli intelligence assumes the crash was an operation of, quote, Arab international terror. Arens also attacked the U.S.-PLO dialogue, saying such steps would only strengthen the wave of terror and encourage terror groups and activities. In El Salvador, guerrilla forces attacked the main headquarters of the Salvadoran Armed Forces. The attack came late this morning, less than 12 hours after an attack on the National University left one person dead and a major building destroyed by explosives. Gene Palumbo reports from San Salvador.
In striking at the army headquarters, the rebels set off four car bombs and apparently used catapults to fire other explosives into the heart of the military compound. One person inside was reported killed and another two were wounded. But it was the civilian population outside which bore the brunt of the attack. Two civilians were reported killed and another 36 wounded. Three of the car bombs went off outside a public health clinic near the army headquarters. There was speculation that the guerrilla assault was a reprisal for the attack at the university in the early morning hours. At a press conference later Friday morning, the president of the National University blamed the Army High Command and the government of President José Napoleón Duarte for the attack on the school. For National Public Radio, this is Gene Palumbo in San Salvador.
A tanker truck carrying propane gas exploded on Interstate 240 in downtown Memphis today, creating a huge fireball that killed at least six people. The blast threw the tanker 125 yards onto a house. The fireball burned five houses on both sides of the highway and engulfed several cars. The tanker was apparently involved in an accident. The sister of kidnapped American reporter Terry Anderson today asked his captors to release him in time for Christmas. This will be the fourth Christmas in captivity for Terry Anderson, who was the chief Middle East correspondent for the Associated Press when he was kidnapped in Beirut in March of 1985. His sister, Peggy Say, wrote an open letter to the kidnappers that was published today in Beirut newspapers. Although she appealed for his release, she acknowledged there is little hope in her heart that her brother will be freed. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Some of the all-time greats of rock and roll are with us for the holidays, courtesy of our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward. For starters, a traditional tune arranged by Booker T. and the MGs.
is it about rock and roll and Christmas? Here you've got this incredibly rebellious, authority-defying, parent-hating, nasty music, and yet when you start going through its past, you realize that it's built up a catalog of Christmas music second only to the Lutheran Church. In the early days, of course, a lot of black groups and singers released records at Christmas to see if they couldn't beat the sales record of Charles Brown's classic, Merry Christmas, Baby.
Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice. Give me a diamond ring for Christmas. Now I'm living in paradise.
None of them could, of course, and the song remains one of the best-selling rhythm and blues records of all time. And I suppose it's no surprise that Colonel Parker would have had Elvis record a Christmas album in 1957, nor is it any surprise that this rewrite of Teddy Bear was on it.
I don't need a lot of presents to make my Christmas bright. I just need my baby's arms wound around me tight. Oh, Santa, hear my plea. Santa, bring my baby back to me.
Santa, bring my baby back to me.
What was a surprise was the deeply reverent second side of the album.
Oh, little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. Above thy deep and dreamless sleep, the silent stars move by.
It's worth getting for Elvis's version of Peace in the Valley alone. Of course, once rock and roll was an established fact in the late 50s, all manner of garbage started flowing, frankly commercial and sometimes memorable.
Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock, jingle bells. And blowing up bushels of fun. Now the jingle hop has begun. Jingle bell, jingle bell, jingle bell rock.
Who could forget Bobby Helms? And who hasn't tried? Hey, I could have played you Mamacita, Donde es Santa Claus, another 50s ghost of Christmas past. But it was the 60s, when you'd figure that most people would rather be smoking the Christmas tree than rocking around it, that produced some of the oddest rock and roll Christmas records. The godfather of soul, James Brown, released not one, but two Christmas albums, the first of which contains this masterpiece.
Hi, everybody. This is James Brown. This is a very, very unusual way to come to you. But I gotta start by saying thanks. Thanks for such a wonderful year. Not only to you, to God, number one. To you, number two. And for all the wonderful things. You know, when I look at a beautiful day, I say,
let's
God is happy.
Make this Christmas mean something this year.
It goes on like that for a long time. Poor James. This year for Christmas, he got 6 years in jail. Let's hope Santa brings him an appeal strategy. Across the Atlantic, the Beatles proved that they were softies around the holiday season, too. Even though they never released a Christmas song per se, their fan club got to enjoy personalized greetings every year in the form of a special record.
All my trouble seems so far away. Now it looks as though we're here to stay. I believe in yesterday.
Don't forget, Christmas is coming. Oh, that reminds me. Let's do a Christmas record.
Let's do a Christmas record.
Yeah, what should we say?
That's a good idea.
We've got to thank everyone. Remember to thank.
Yeah. Thank
you. You can't ad-lib too much because you miss. Well, thank you, Johnny. It's been nice to know you.
Got to thank everyone for all the presents this year.
Yes.
And, all for buying the records.
Yeah, especially the chewed-up pieces of chewing gum and the playing cards made out of knickers.
On behalf of John and I, George speaking, I'd like to thank you for all the Christmas cards and presents and birthday cards and presents and everything, too.
That was part of the 1965 message, and the records, like the Beatles, got weirder as time went on. And speaking of weird, here's a Christmas record by the very last person you'd ever expect to have made one. Jimi Hendrix mixing together The Little Drummer Boy, Silent Night, and Auld Lang Syne. This is just a fraction of the rock and roll Christmas music that's out there, and I'm sure you'll hear plenty more of it before the season's over. Sure, some of it was written to make money, but plenty of it, I bet, was created purely and simply out of the good feelings that seem to be in the air at this time of year.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. In the new movie comedy Working Girl, Melanie Griffith plays Tess McGill, a woman from Staten Island who works as a secretary on Wall Street. She wants to get her rightful place in the business world. She thinks of herself as having a head for business and a body for sin. Her male bosses have only noticed the body for sin. But her new boss is a woman, played by Sigourney Weaver.
I've never worked for somebody who was younger than me before. Or for a woman.
Well, there's a first time for everything. That's not going to be a problem, is it, Tess?
No.
Good. Well, why don't you pour us a couple of coffees and come on inside? I'm light. No sugar.
When Sigourney Weaver is in an accident out of town, Melanie Griffith impersonates the boss and starts a business deal with a junior executive played by Harrison Ford. The screenplay for Working Girl was written by Kevin Wade, who until now is best known for his play Key Exchange. I asked Wade what the inspiration was behind the story for Working Girl.
There was, a moment or a day when I was down in Battery Park and saw all these women pouring out of the subway. I mean, they sort of came off boats and out of holes in the ground. And it was just this kind of teeming masses pouring into these buildings. And right across the harbor is the Statue of Liberty, and right next to that is Ellis Island, where, they used to bring the immigrants with land and, come to America. And it was, that was the most visual and most specific inspiration I can think of, was that it started really as a, what is the modern day version of, that guy who lands on Ellis Island, settles on the Lower East Side, sells umbrellas on 14th Street, and ends up, starting Bloomingdale's or something.
I like your image of people pouring out of boats and holes in the ground, but I feel like I ought to explain it for for our listeners who haven't been to New York, that the boats are the Staten Island Ferry and the holes in the ground are the New York subways. So you see this as a story of what happens when someone from one of the boroughs, one of the New York boroughs, tries to come to New York and make it.
One of the New York boroughs and one of the those really who aren't in the club of college-educated, a certain kind of background and breeding that, although we supposedly don't have a class system in this country, it's the theory of the picture or of the script that there in fact is one. It's not by birth so much as it is by education and connections and all.
In the movie, the Melanie Griffith character, who starts off as a secretary, goes to work as a secretary for the character played by Sigourney Weaver, who's a very successful Wall Street executive. Mm-hmm. And Sigourney Weaver gives her a whole initiation rap about how their relationship should be a two-way street. And this whole two-way street rap is filled with all kinds of executive type of jargon. Did you have this language down already?
No, I listened, you know, and it's a amalgamation of Wall Street talk, Hollywood talk, military talk. It's just that kind of can-do. I almost, you know, right. You know the way Haig used to speak? It's the way General Haig speaks.
Perfect. Everything's in place.
For what?
Man I've been seeing for a while. I think he's it. And I think this could be the weekend we decide. He said there was something very important he wanted to discuss with me. I think he's gonna pop the question.
You do?
I think so. We're in the same city now. I've indicated that I'm receptive to an offer. I've cleared the month of June, and I am, after all, me.
Well, what if he doesn't pop the question?
I really don't think that's a variable.
Well, now that you have to work in Hollywood, you know, for your movie scripts and so on, do you find that there's a lot of this kind of biz language that you have to learn?
Nah, just please send the check. And no, I really don't. But people will talk about, oh, a scene having, you know, that we need two more colors in this scene, or that it needs to be 80% funnier. And things that are like as if they could put up a chart. I've always tried, you know, if I make it 20% less sad, does that equal 40% funnier, or what exactly? You know, so there is talk there, but you know, you don't. They can understand you.
Working Girl was directed by Mike Nichols. Did Nichols ask for any changes from you, or did he add things at all into the storyline or into little comedic bits?
Well, we did a rewrite together, a bit of work on it, where he essentially, and I think it's like the greatest, one of the great lessons you learn from Nichols, is that even something as so-called movie as this, that the character motivation, the action, and everything must come from life and not from other movies. And he encouraged me all the time to go back and say, okay, now here's a great movie scene, but what is it about this scene that happens to, you know, that happens in fact in real life, that somebody sitting in the audience can say, you know, I am that guy, I was that guy, I know that guy. So I did a lot of that with him. And then when it came time to get both Sigourney and Harrison, I, with Mike, and then, you know, obviously by myself, went off and fixed up their parts, so that in Sigourney's case it was not quite so treacherous, so that she could play treacherous.
Explain what you just said.
As written, it was a little more treacherous, so that you would know right off the bat that this was the villain, which didn't give her any room to make up her own villain. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I just went back and the sort of corporate speak you were talking about before, and tried to do more of that, and really just tried to give her a line that, in fact, yes, she's ruthless, but there's a logical place for her in the corporate world. She didn't have to come on with a black hat. She just has a different way of doing things.
A sexual politics question.
Ah.
The villain of the movie is Sigourney Weaver,
mm-hmm.
and she's kind of... Am I giving too much away to say she's deposed at the end? That she gets her comeuppance?
No, I mean, I'm guessing that you expect it, so.
Okay. Now, it's, you know, the villain here is someone who's really a kind of newcomer to the system anyway, since it's so recently that
right.
women executives have been allowed in. And I was wondering
right.
if you had second thoughts at all about making the villain a woman who, if we're seeing it as an immigrant movie, is really a recent immigrant.
None whatsoever. the immigrant part of the story. Well, first of all, Catherine, it does exemplify that sort of class and connections part of the story that is the invisible barrier that Tess has to break through. But when I went to write this, the idea, and I think I read in the Village Voice or something, the critic suggested that the movie would have been real good if the villain had been a man, which is something I think you've seen a million times. I mean, what do? Tess comes in, he chases her around the desk, he treats her lousy. That's been done a lot of times. There's something interesting. I mean, I suppose someone will do it, that character, more sympathetically or something, but there is, you know, you point out they are recent immigrants, and there's something to me comic about the way that women at that level have to try to act like men, or how they think men, you know, take care of business. So they're really trying on a suit of armor that they've never worn before, and sometimes it's comical.
This is your first produced movie screenplay, right?
Yes.
Why did you want to make a movie? You'd done several plays before.
It pays well. I in fact, you know, had tried once or twice before, but I like to write them. You do, frankly, you get paid for them. I'm not trying to sound like mercenary here or anything, but that's a consideration. And I always loved them. I grew up watching movies, you know, like everybody else did, but I never had the same feeling about the theater, though I love working in the theater. People always describe it as, oh, the magic that happens when the curtain goes up, etc. That feeling I always got from going to the movies.
Okay. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks.
Kevin Wade wrote the screenplay for the new movie, Working Girl. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. with a preview of All Things Considered. Robert, I'm sure you'll be covering the news on tonight's show.
Mm-hmm.
But the big story is that tonight is the All Things Considered Christmas pageant.
That's right, Terry. The credibility of National Public Radio is secure and intact, at least for minutes. After that, I can't vouch for. This is an event for which our entire news staff has been working, above all, producer Ira Glass and our commentator, narrator, Daniel Pinkwater. This is it. The big night. The Wizard Crystal.
What role are you cast in?
Let's put it this way. I'm not one of the frogs.
Oh, okay. Oh. Sounds like fun. Okay, well, good luck, Robert.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for All Things Considered from National Public Radio. You can't live in America and not know Bill Cosby, from his television show, his records, or the many commercials in which he appears. Critic at large Laurie Stone recently saw Cosby perform his stand-up act at Carnegie Hall, and she has this review.
The first thing I notice is that there aren't a lot of black faces among the fancy dress audience. Orchestra tickets cost $100, and the cheapest seats are $35. Most of the ushers, wearing short red jackets, are black, and there is Cosby, who looks great in a beautifully tailored tan suit. At 51, he's no longer jockish, but he's vigorous and prosperous-looking. Still, there stands a black entertainer before a sea of rich, mostly white faces, attended by a service staff that is mostly black. What are the options? Richard Pryor would dive into the race study, taking the skinny boy license to draw blood and plead puniness. He'd be vicious, hilarious, tilting the minstrel format of race humor to his advantage. The pain of being made to feel insignificant because of color continues to burn in him. Eddie Murphy, on the other hand, wouldn't expose that vulnerability even if he felt it. He'd use the occasion to show off his shrewdness, display his amusement about white anxieties, demonstrate who's in control and being entertained. But Cosby doesn't say a word about race, not one. There was a time when Jewish comedians, I'm thinking of Jack Benny and George Burns, didn't comment on their backgrounds. They worried about anti-Semitic backlash. And when a later generation of Borscht Belters came up, it was a sign of liberation to flaunt their ghetto origins. But a black person who looks black can never elude ethnicity, and Cosby knows this. Whenever he shows his face, he presents an image of blackness, wealth, and professional success. That combination adds up to racial pride, and it's given weight by Cosby's recent $20 million donation to the women's school, Spelman College. He's also conscientious about hiring minorities of varying backgrounds for his show. At Carnegie Hall, he signaled to the audience and to the black ushers that some blacks have made it so successfully they don't have to call attention to race, and he pulled it off. As for his comedy, it's uneven, though Cosby can still milk charm and wit from the oldest business in the book, wife jokes and toilet humor. He says his wife protests the way he arranges her uncomfortably in bed, supposedly out of love, and when he farts, she tells him to shut up. Like Rodney Dangerfield, who puts wise barbs in the mouths of women for whom he pines, Cosby lets his wife articulate what we've seen in his persona and what he occasionally shows on his sitcom, a tyrant who wants to come off cute. But Cosby repeats himself shamelessly and remains focused unswervingly on domestic life. His egotism, though mocked, eventually takes over. He imagines that the force of his personality exempts him from shaping his work. His aggression against his wife, who is always my wife and never Camille, subsumes the advantage he ceded her. She begins sounding bitter, the jealous second to a great man. When Cosby's motives are honest, he's funny, and not merely about himself but about human nature. Too often, unfortunately, the observant part of him isn't after change, just buying more time to go on being what he is.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Ronnie Spector remembers her days as the lead singer of the Ronettes, one of the greatest girl groups of the 60s, and she fills us in on some of the things that she's done since then. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead runs down his picks for the 10 best jazz albums of 1988. And television critic David Bianculli reviews the Karen Carpenter story about the life and death of the anorexic pop star. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.